to the break.
All right, welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. We do have a quorum. Representative Murphy moves approval of minutes from March 28th. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. All right. Members, what we're going to do is a quick walkthrough of 9:45 with the articles from the researchers. Then we're going to take up the bill and the amendment and go through that. Then we'll go through the member amendments and final discussion and wrap up of the bill. We had public testimony yesterday, so we don't anticipate any public testimony today. I do anticipate that we're going to be able to complete this within the time that we have allotted for our regular committee time. Just based on that, if we do need to come back, we can do so this evening, but we do have other committees that are also scheduled. So we want to be attentive to that. With that, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when our researchers go through the walkthrough, if they could at least for us identify and maybe dig in a little further on the pieces that are new to the bill, that would be real helpful.
And particularly minority caucus members have any questions about which bill or what's just chime in and we'll try to get them answered on the fly. That'll probably be easier. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a process question because I'm still relatively new at this. So with the items that are new, would folks who testified, I guess if they're being highlighted as being new, but the testimony was yesterday, if there are folks who, I don't know that this is the case, but if there are members of the public who would want to testify regarding any of those new items, would that have been highlighted for them in some way to know that as of yesterday, if you understand what I'm asking?
Well, the bill was posted in its entirety. That was what the posting was for public testimony. So some of that was to that, but it wasn't specifically designated as such.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. If we could have Article 1, Mr. Chun, and then we'll just proceed. And then rather than calling on the researchers, if you just perhaps follow along and move through the bill, that would be great. Mr. Chun.
And now, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that you just want staff to go over the new provisions in each article?
Yeah, if you could just maybe give a general description of the article, but highlight specifically any new portions. You're pretty speedy anyway, just a general walkthrough, but specifically highlighting anything new.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair and members, Article 1 is the health care article. This is the article with provisions related to medical assistance and Minnesota care. Section 1, this is House File 2131. These are language related to OLA audits of the Department of Human Services programs. Then Section 2, this is related to House File 1195, Representative Albright. These are grants to providers when establishing new mental health programs. Then the next three sections, sections 3, 4, and 5, are from House File 1559. This is the governor's language on MA hospital reimbursement methodology. Section 6, this is House File 1619. This is an alternate inpatient payment rate for children's hospitals. Sections 7 through 12 also deal with inpatient hospital payment rates, House File 1559. Section 13, this is related to House File 1553, dealing with non-emergency medical transportation. Sections 14 and 15, this is language from House File 1819. This is language setting a new payment methodology for outpatient drugs under MA. It's tied to conformity with the federal outpatient drug rule. Then sections 16 through 19 deal with non-emergency medical transportation. Section 20, this is from House File 1195. clarifying that MA coverage of psychiatric residential treatment facilities must be provided in accordance with the later section in the bill. Section 21 is House File 106, expanding the services that can be provided by community emergency medical technicians. Section 22 is House File 808, allowing the EPSDT program to cover stereopental if certain conditions are met. Section 23, this is House File 202, an exemption from Rule 101 for rural dentists. Section 24 is House File 1414. These are making changes to the Integrated Health Partnership Demonstration Project. Then House File 25 is a new section. This language is in House File 2564, but this bill did not have a hearing, so this sets up a new direct contracting demonstration project. Then Section 26 is from House File 1195. It specifies eligibility and services for psychiatric residential treatment facilities. Section 27 is from that same bill. Then the next two sections, Sections 28 and 29, are from House File 1194. They deal with state-only payment for certain facilities that are classified as institutions for mental diseases. Then Sections 30, 31, and 32 are from House File 629, dealing with MA claims against the states. Section 32 is House File 102. This is expanding an existing intergovernmental transfer for ambulance services. Then this same section, paragraphs E and F, are new language. These establish an intergovernmental transfer for the University of Minnesota and University of Minnesota Physicians. Sections 34 and 35 are related to this new IGT. Then section 36, this is a new provision. This is managed care withhold that is tied to enrollees submitting a verification of coverage form. And if this form is not received by the commissioner, the commissioner does not return the withheld funds. It ceases making capitation payments, and it would disenroll the enrollee. Section 37, this is House File 1739, new language on competitive bidding. Section 38, this is another provision from House File 1559, dealing with MA hospital reimbursement. Section 39 is House File 1703, Representative Barr. These are rates for home visits by public health nurses. Section 40 is from House File 1405, Representative Zerlas. This is payment for certain ventilators under MA. Then Sections 41 through 43, House File 2115. This is the Hospital Outcomes Program. Then Section 44, it's a new provision. It increases premiums for Minnesota care enrollees, and this section increases premiums to the maximum allowed under the Federal Affordable Care Act. Section 45 is a delay in capitation payments to managed care plans. It's also a new provision. Section 46 is a study from House File 1194. Section 47 is a rate-setting analysis report from House File 1166. Section 48 is from House File 1705. This is a study of durable medical equipment payments. Section 49 is a new section. It's tied to the Minnesota Care premium increase. And then Section 50 is tied to the Rule 101 exemption for dentists.
Mr. Chair, is it okay to ask questions? I just have a couple of questions about this article. Or do
you
want us to wait?
Okay. Yep, I think that's probably just best. Right. Just to jump right in. Thank Representative
you,
Murphy.
Chair. So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chung, thank you for that walkthrough. I'm wondering if you could just explain a little bit more about the withhold and verification of coverage at Section 36, mm-hmm. and then also if you could walk us through Section 44, which is the premium increase in Minnesota Care, and what those premium increases look like for Minnesotans.
Okay. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy, the withhold would for the period January 1 of 18 through December 31st of 2018 require the Commissioner of Human Services to withhold 2% of capitation payments for each MA enrollee. And then the withhold would be returned, I guess, the following July 1st to July 31st of the following year if certain conditions are met. So the commissioner is to develop a verification of coverage form, and the enrollee is to complete this form and return the form to the plan. So it would be up to the plan to sort of, you know, ensure or notify the enrollee that they would need to complete this form. And then if the form is returned by the plan, then the withhold dollars are returned for that enrollee to the plan. If the form is not returned, the withheld dollars are not returned, the plan will no longer receive capitation and payments for that enrollee, and then the commissioners take steps to disenroll the enrollee from the program. So that's Section 36. Section 45, the premium increase, the language will be found on pages 66 and 67. So this is setting up basically a new increased premium scale for Minnesota Care that would take effect October 1st of 2017. On page 67, you can see the changes by income category, you know, in the premium scale. And as mentioned, these premium increases are the maximum that will be allowed under the Affordable Care Act for a basic health program.
Thank you, Mr. Chun. And just so members can find that, that's on page 67, Article 1, Section 45. And there is an increase for Minnesota Care premiums from up to 55 will go from $4 to $5 to 80% will go from $6 to $7. 90% goes from $8 to $11. 100% of poverty goes from $10 to $12. 110 goes from $12 to $13. 100 skipping up to 150% goes from $25 to $32. 160% goes from $29 to $40. 170 goes from $33 to $48. 180 goes from $38 to $56. And 190 goes from $43 to $65. And the highest would be 200% at from $75 to $85, so a $10 change. But those are the monthly changes in premium. The other piece that you asked about was what I refer to as the I'm not a robot, which says that if we want to make sure that enrollees are here and that they're that they certify that they are eligible. So that's all it requires for that. But to make sure that people who haven't died or moved away or just otherwise, so those checks just aren't going to the plans, that we're making sure that they're going to people. So that's the two sections.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I will want to think this through a little bit more, the Section 36 on the contracts and the withhold. But it seems to me it undercuts presumptive eligibility. And I keep thinking about when we worked on GAMC together and Monica Nielsen from St. Stephen's came in with all the applications that had been sent to people who actually don't have a home. And they couldn't complete them, and so they lost their coverage. So if the health plan needs to get a verification form from an individual and they have moved or they don't get the mail or they don't have a home, it seems to me that, as I understand this, they could lose their coverage. And I don't know that if that's what your intention is, but I think I want to put that on the record now and then talk about it a little bit more.
Yep, something we'll have to figure out how to do the outreach. It's up to the plans, but they definitely have skin in the game to make sure that their enrollees are who they are and where they are. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're on this topic, I just would like to understand a little bit more about the finances of this, and I'm talking about the increase in the Minnesota care premiums. So I don't know, probably Mr. Berg rather than Mr. Chun would answer, but I just wonder if it has impact on any other funds. Like, does this impact what the state gets for the BHP? Where does, I'm looking through my spreadsheet to try to find it. I'm sure it's in here somewhere, but if you could just understand a little bit more about what funds it impacts or doesn't impact when we raise these premiums, that would be helpful.
Mr. Berg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the Minnesota Care Premiums item begins on line 774 on page 21. And you'll see that there is a net impact to the healthcare access fund, saving it a modest amount of money. The only other thing that is impacted is the amount of money we get from the federal government for the BHP is not impacted. What's impacted is how much of that money is spent in the current year on the BHP, because as the premium revenue goes up, we spend that as part of it, and then a little bit less of the BHP money is spent in that year.
Okay, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. That's helpful to know. And then if we're spending the BHP money, I think that Mr. Berg is talking about, is in that special BHP trust fund. And as I understand it, that money cannot be used for anything else under federal law. And he's nodding that that's correct. So that probably, so I think the effect, at least the effect on the fund, then, as I'm understanding it, is to sort of extend the life of that. It's keep more money in that BHP trust fund, which, I don't know, maybe that's not correct to say it would extend the life, but I guess it depends on what happens down the road. But that's the only it just puts more of a burden on those who have to pay the increased premium, but it doesn't really, it's not money that we can use for anything else in the state budget, if I'm understanding that correctly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it increases the balance in the BHP trust fund account. It cannot be used currently for any other purpose, so it does not offset any other spending. Down the road at some point, presumably that money will get spent on BHP enrollees or the successor to the BHP, whatever that might be.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess then... In consideration of that, I guess I would ask the question of the chair. I don't necessarily disagree that there could be some adjustment to people. I actually had a contact from a constituent who told me that they could pay a little more for their Minnesota care premiums. I'm not contesting that. But I'm just kind of wondering, if it doesn't impact the budget, it doesn't help us in terms of budgeting, why you are doing that, raising the premium at this point. Since we didn't have a hearing on this, I hope you can give us some at least rationale for why you're doing this when it doesn't help with the overall budget.
Representative Liebling, I think that the increases for Minnesotans who are currently on the basic health plan that are for a family of four making $50,000 a year, to go from $75 to $85 a year might be, or $85 a month might be something that would be fair relative to the individual market in particular. But you're right, it does not affect our general fund target. But it also, I think that the more uncertainty that we have federally, I think that we do need to look at the prudent uses of both the healthcare access fund and as well as this dedicated fund for the BHP. I think we need to make sure that we are on as firm a footing as we possibly can. And it just seemed to make some sense to do that and to try to provide more stability so that it can pay for itself long term.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I do think that there's, we have a pretty fractured healthcare system. There is no question about it. It has all these cliffs, and we don't have something that's really rational in terms of people's part that they pay going up smoothly with how much income they have. And I would sure like to see us smooth that out. I'm not sure this gets us there. I'm not, as I said, I'm not really opposed to the idea that we should make it more smooth it out. I think that would be great if we had a more rational healthcare system overall, because I think that some people are spending far too much or being asked to pay far too much for insurance. But I think it would have been nice if we could have had a hearing on this, because I think it has this is something that I think Minnesotans probably would have liked to have known about more and had more of a chance to weigh in on. But, you know, again, it doesn't impact our it's just interesting to me that you're talking about stabilizing this fund when I know you've not exactly been a friend of the program in the past. So I hope that's changed and that you're really interested in stabilizing this program, making sure it goes forward for Minnesotans who need it.
I'm always in favor of having enough money to pay the bills. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the new sections that wasn't heard is Section 25, which is a healthcare delivery systems demonstration project that would be authorized to go into effect next January.
Yep.
And, you know, I think in the insurance market, we've heard over and over again that part of the problem is if you divide the market up too many ways, you start to have some risk management kind of issues in the private sector, and I think that's probably true in our public programs, too. And I'm wondering if we could hear a little bit more about the rationale of adding something in addition to our integrated health partnership demonstrations, which we have been doing for some years. It potentially pulls both from fee-for-service and managed care, which I think is the first time we've pulled from fee-for-service. So if we could get some background on whether or not there's any fiscal implications.
Sure, and I'm happy to do that. I think it might make more sense to walk through the sections, and I was glad to cover those too because those are significant and somewhat controversial, so I was happy to cover that. But why don't we wait until those sections are covered? And then we can address that there might be more questions if that's satisfactory, Representative Loeffler. I'll come back to you for that.
Okay.
All right. And before Mr. Chun continues, I just want to thank Representative Considine for the delicious apple crisp that you made. The committee enjoyed that. Thank you. All right.
My pleasure.
Representative Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, I think unless there are other questions, I think we're now in Article 2 for the walkthrough.
All right. Article 2.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 2 is the continuing care article. This article makes changes to provisions related to hospital swing beds, TEFRA, home health services, ICFDD payments, DWRS, CDCS, and various other programs. So I'll just start going through the sections. Section 1 is a related to penalties for late or non-submission of nursing facility information, and this comes from House File 500. Section 2 is related to swing beds. It comes from House File 1115. Section 3 is related to certain maximum charges for supplemental nursing services, and that's from House File 582. Section 4 is the first of several sections related to the Disability Waiver Rate System, or DWRS. There are sections throughout this article related to that. Sections 4, 6, 17 through 26, 67, 69, and paragraph B of the repealer in section 70 are all related to the DWRS package. This is something that is a little bit new. We heard House File 814 and also House File 1239 that were both related to this. And then the governor had a separate proposal in his bill, and this, I think, takes elements of all of those things. so it looks a bit different from any of those proposals. Section 5 is related to the TEFRA parental fees. That came from House File 1182. This is a modified version of that. Section 6 is one of the DWRS sections. Section 7 relates to caregiver supports, and that's from House File 941. Sections 8 through 14 are all from House File 1532 related to home health services and face-to-face encounters. Sections 15 and 16 are from House File 500. That's the nursing facility value-based reimbursement bill. And then, as I said before, sections 17 through 26 are all related to the DWRS modifications. Section 27 is from House File 1445. This is related to the budget methodology for CDCS. Section 28 is related to filing appeals, and that is a new section. Section 29 comes from House File 921. This is related to ICFDD therapeutic leave day payments. Section 30 comes from House File 1913. This is a special rate increase for an ICFDD in Murray County. Sections 31 through 39 come from House File 774. This is Representative Pearson's bill to modernize the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Act. Sections 40 through 48 all come from House File 500, the Nursing Facility Value-Based Reimbursement Policy and Technical Changes. Section 49 comes from House File 1341, which I don't think we heard in this committee, but it's related to notice to private pay residents of nursing facilities when there are rate increases. Sections 50 through 59 are all from House File 500, the Nursing Facility Value-Based Reimbursement Bill. Section 60 comes from House File 490, which was Representative Lean's bill related to providing a special payment rate for a nursing facility in Moorhead. Section 61 comes from House File 1445. That's another piece of the CDCS budget methodology bill. Section 62 comes from House File 262. It's the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. Section 63 is another piece of House File 1445, the CDCS budget methodology changes. Sections 64 and 65 are another piece of House File 774, making changes to the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Act. Section 66 comes from House File 1649, which was Representative Haley's bill related to an electronic service delivery documentation system. Section 67 is another piece of the DWRS package. Section 68 is new. This is just a direction to the commissioner to do a study of ICFDD payment rates. Section 69 is another piece of the DWRS package. And Section 70 is a repealer. Paragraph A comes from House File 774, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Act Modernization Bill, and Paragraph B relates to the DWRS package.
Mr. Chair and members, moving on to Article 3, this is the Health Department and Public Health Article. Section 1 of this article is from House File 345. It establishes a Palliative Care Advisory Committee. Section 2 comes from House File 2304. It authorizes the use of certain handheld dental x-ray equipment. Section 3 is from House File 804. It expands who is eligible for health professional education loan forgiveness. Section 4 is from House File 803. It establishes a senior care workforce innovation grant program. Section 5 is from House File 743. It establishes a primary care and mental health professions clinical training expansion grant program for physician assistants, APRNs, pharmacists, dental therapists, and mental health professionals. Section 6 is a new section. It modifies the what is currently called the primary care residency expansion grant program to allow grants for training for two additional types of physicians, and renames the program. Section 7 is from House File 2150. It establishes the statewide tobacco quitline service. Section 8 is from House File 1371. It establishes a moratorium exception to allow an expansion of Prairie Care's inpatient psychiatric hospital in Brooklyn Park to add 21 new beds. Section 9 is a new section. It establishes a Minnesota Biomedicine and Bioethics Innovation Grant Program. Section 10 is an enforcement piece of House File 2304. It allows the handheld dental x-ray equipment section to be enforced using the health department's existing enforcement statutes. Sections 11 and 12 are from House File 2063. They relate to the use of fines collected from home care providers. Sections 13 and 14 come from House File 582. They make modifications to the supplemental nursing services regulation. Sections 15 to 34 come from House File 1730. They establish a new chapter licensing prescribed pediatric extended care centers. And now we're on page 28 of the summary. Section 35 comes from House File 714. It moves funds that are in current statute are authorized for use by the Commissioner of Public Safety. Those funds are moved to the Commissioner of Health to be used for services to serve sexually exploited youth. Section 36 is another section from House File 1730 regarding PPEC centers. It directs the Commissioner of Human Services to set payment rates for PPEC centers. Section 37 is from House File 714. This is the other part. This is related to the change in Section 35. This moves the money from public safety to health. Sections 38 to 41 are also from House File 1730. They add references to PPEC centers and the Maltreatment of Minors Act. Section 42 is from House File 1714. It establishes brain health pilot programs in the health department. Section 43 is from House File 2047, directs the Commissioner of Health to establish a comprehensive plan to end HIV/AIDS. Section 44 is from House File 1730. It directs the Commissioner of Human Services to seek any necessary waivers relating to payments for PPEC centers. Section 45 is from House File 1490. It establishes early dental disease prevention pilot program at the Department of Health. Section 46 is a new section. It directs the Commissioner of Health to consult with interested stakeholders to make recommendations on how to improve quality and safety for long-term care services and supports. And it requires a report and recommendations to be submitted to the legislature. Section 47 is from House File 713. It directs the creation of a statewide sex trafficking victims strategic plan. Section 48 is from House File 464. It requires a study on and report on the home care nursing workforce shortage. Section 49 is from House File 1714. It establishes a youth sports concussion working group. And Section 50 is from House File 334. It repeals the Minnesota Radon Licensing Act.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 4 is the Children and Families article. This article makes changes to child care assistance programs, child care licensing, GRH, and foster care. Section 1 of this bill comes, or this article comes from House File 139. This modifies child care assistance program maximum rates for facilities in St. Cloud. And then I'm going to skip over to page, the bottom of page 33 of the summary in section 13. That comes from House File 1804 that modifies GRH individual eligibility requirements. For people who are receiving licensed residential crisis stabilization services. Section 14 comes from House File 1522. This modifies the GRH moratorium on development of group residential housing beds. Section 15 comes from House File 885. This provides a supplementary GRH rate for a facility in St. Louis County. Section 16 comes from House File 1406 that provides a GRH supplemental rate for a facility in Anoka County. Section 17 comes from House File 1188 that allows for the transfer of emergency shelter funds. Section 18 also comes from House File 1804, making changes to GRH. It's related to people that are receiving licensed residential crisis stabilization services. I'll skip over section 19. Section 20 is from House File 1660, which I don't think we heard in this committee. It provides for mobile food shelf grants. Section 21 comes from House File 1870, which I also don't think we heard in this establishes a pilot project called Minnesota Pathways to Prosperity, Dakota and Olmsted County. I'll skip over 22. Section 23 is new, and that provides a direction for the commissioner to do a study of GRH supplementary service rates.
And Mr. Chair and members, we'll go back to page 31 now in the summary. Sections 2 and 3 are from House File 986. These sections remove the liability insurance restriction for homeowners who have an individual in foster care. And the Section 3 also raises the amount the state is required to compensate for property damage. Sections 4 and 5 and Sections 7 and 8 are from House File 1422. They relate to family child care licensing and training requirements. It changed the definition of annual or annually to make trainings easier to complete. They changed the requirements for posting correction orders, make it clear that correction orders are there can't be quotas for any correction orders or licensing actions. And also from 1422, sections 10 and 11 require the commissioner to inform family child care license holders of changes in laws and statutes. And section 11 requires a report to the legislature on the status of child care. Going back, section 6 is from House File 1311 that requires an exit interview to be offered to child care license holders before the end of the licensing inspection. Section 9 is also from House File 1311. This establishes the child care fix-it ticket in lieu of a correction order for certain violations. And there is a new part in Section 9 that was not in the original bill that just requires a report by the commissioner identifying which violations are eligible for a fix-it ticket. Going to Section 12, this exempts family child care programs from the positive support strategies requirements. Let's see, we'll skip to Section 19 on page 34. This was from House File 987, and this requires responsible social services agencies to provide services to individuals who left foster care at 18 or slightly before and wish to re-enter foster care. Section 22 is new. It simply requires the commissioner to develop guidelines and consult with stakeholders for posting public child care licensing data. And Section 24 is from House Bill 604, the Hands-Off Child Care Act. It repeals sections allowing certain family child care providers to unionize. Moving to Section 5, the Health Occupations Article makes changes to the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse licensing requirements and the provisions governing the practice of psychology. It also modifies requirements and procedures for certain dental professionals and clarifies what constitutes the practice of telemedicine, and it repeals the expiration of the medical faculty licensure section. So Section 1 just defines telemedicine and clarifies when telemedicine can be used. That was in House File 1314. Sections 2 through 6 were from House File 733. They relate to the licensure and the requirements for licensure for advanced practice registered nurses. And Sections 7 through 23 are some changes to the Psychological Practice Act, or Psychology Practice Act. Changes some definitions, licensure requirements, supervision requirements, and then Section 24. Sections 24 to 26 were from House File 1110. And these sections add dental therapists and dental assistants to the list of professionals for whom examination requirements can be waived, requires some different things about dental assistants licensure, and allows these professionals to perform certain procedures. And Section 27 is a revisor's instruction to change the headnote of Section 147.0375. This was from House File 959. And related to that, in the repealer in Section 28, the expiration for the medical faculty licensure is repealed, as are several sections related to the changes to the Psychology Practice Act. Moving to Section 6, the Chemical and Mental Health Article. This article makes changes to the state substance use disorder treatment services, increases rates for chemical dependency services and mental health services, and provides for targeted case management through interactive video, and establishes a grant program. So, let's see, Sections 1 through 8 are from House File 1938. These are the changes to the Substance Use Disorder Treatment Services. These sections expand the providers that are included as eligible vendors for certain services. And Section 9 is from House File 872. This section provides for a 3% rate increase for chemical dependency services listed in statute, and this changed a little bit from the original bill. I believe it was it was a different percentage, and it provided for sort of graduated increases as the years progressed. Sections 10 through 13 allow for targeted case management services to be conducted by interactive video in certain residential settings. Section 14 requires the MA payment rate for mental health clinics that are not designated as essential community providers to be the same as for those designated as essential community providers for certain listed services. There is a new part in this section that would require the provider receiving the increased rate to demonstrate a commitment to serve low-income and underserved populations. And section 15 is a mental health innovation grant program. This is from House File 737. And section 16 relates to House File 1938 and just requires the commissioner to develop a substance use disorder treatment program model that is not subject to the federal IMD exclusion and requires a report to the legislative committees. Section 17 is related to House File 529 and instructs the commissioner to seek federal approval to implement the interactive video case management. And Section 18 is the repealer, and it repeals a section related to the MA rate increase.
Mr. Chair, Article 7 contains provisions related to opiate abuse prevention. Section 1 is from House File 2066. This will limit prescriptions for opiates to a four-day supply when used for the treatment of acute dental pain or acute pain associated with refractive surgery. And there's a provision that would allow the practitioner, based on professional judgment, to prescribe more than a four-day supply. Section 2 is from House File 1135. This would require a dispenser to provide certain specified information when prescribing an opioid to a patient. Section 3 is from House File 770. This modifies the MA payment methods used for non-scheduled injectable drugs, and it would allow direct payment to the pharmacy. Section 4 is from House File 2325. This was a bill that did not receive a hearing. And this prohibits the assessment of patient satisfaction with pain management to be used in determining provider compensation or provider quality incentive payments under MA and Minnesota Care. Section 5 is from House File 2140. This requires the Commissioner of Health to establish opioid abuse prevention pilot projects in geographic areas of the state. Section 6 is a new provision. This requires the Commissioner of Human Services to report to the legislature on funds received as part of a federal targeted response to the opioid crisis grants and how the funds were used. Now, it also requires the Commissioner to use any remaining grant funds and other funds to provide these as grants to counties for opioid abuse prevention, increase public awareness, and prevent opioid abuse. Section 7 is House File 1837. This is the bill that did not have a hearing. This section directs the commissioner to develop and authorize a demonstration project with the Rehabilitation Institute that would pay the institute using bundled payments for chronic pain rehabilitation therapy for MA enrollees.
Moving on to Article 8, this is the most miscellaneous article. Section 1 modifies the definition of controlling individual in the Human Services Licensing Act. This came from House File 1245, which was not heard in this committee, but which was heard in the Reform Committee. Section 2
comes from House File 1207, which was not heard. It defines owner for the Human Services Licensing Act. Sections 3 to 5 come from House File 10. Section 3 establishes some legislative notice and approval requirements for certain federal waivers and approvals, 1332 waivers, 1115 waivers, or state Medicaid plan amendments. Section 4 directs the Commissioner of Commerce to come up with a plan for moving from MNSURE to a federally facilitated marketplace. And Section 5 repeals the MNSURE statutes effective January 1 of 2019.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 9 is related to nursing facility technical corrections. This article corrects obsolete cross-references that were created by the nursing facility recodification that was enacted last year, and it also removes some obsolete language.
Article 10 is the Human Services Forecast Adjustments article, and Article 11 is the Appropriations article. And that concludes the walkthrough.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am looking at Article 14, excuse me, Section 14 of Article 6, the Critical Access Mental Health Rate Increase. And just wondering, I don't know if Mr. Goodnow is here. I know he was going to work on this issue, and I know it's Representative Heinzman's provision, but in the walkthrough, it talked about how it requires a provider to demonstrate a commitment to serve low-income and underserved populations in order to receive the increased amount. So what we are doing in this provision is extending critical access status to providers, and the critical access dentists we've talked about before have to see everybody. They can't turn people away, and that's part of the reason why they get extra payment. And I know that there was going to be some negotiation on that, and I'm just wondering if someone could share just a little more. Mr. Goodnow, just like that.
Representative Murphy, just so that we're all on the same page, could you cite the page in the summary that you're recalling?
Yes, I'm on page 42 of the summary.
Thank you. Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee.
Respond to the question.
Yeah, Kevin Goodnow, here on behalf of Nystrom Associates. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the language that was inserted in there was, which was suggested by you or something along that lines, is actually pulled out of the Essential Community Provider Statute as it relates to covering people of low income. So the only difference that I could tell in that is that we're actually not giving them Essential Community Provider status. We're just saying that they have to meet the standards with the way they treat individuals of low income in order to get that higher rate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Goodnow.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask about section, so this is Article 4, Section 23. It's page 35 of the summary. And this, as I understand it, was new language. This directs the commissioner to study the group residential housing supplementary service rates. And the particular concern that I had is this says the language of the commissioner has to do that within available appropriations, and that always concerns me when we're asking for something new and then not dedicating dollars, is then the question becomes, what do we not want the department to do? So I guess I'd just like to find out, I don't know if somebody from the department could perhaps comment on how much effort that's going to involve, since this is something new we hadn't heard it before.
And I see someone from the department coming this way. Mr. Burdick, welcome to the committee, sir. Just state your name for the record and respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt Burdick with DHS. We are still reviewing that language. However, we have produced several reports on group residential housing in the recent past, including this most recent legislative session. So we're not aware that we would be able to produce any substantial new findings beyond what those reports without additional resources to do more in-depth analysis.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess it sounds like either you could provide the report that you've already provided, and that there would be some information there, I guess, if folks need that. But then in order to do
something beyond that that would require some funding. It sounds like you're studying to determine how much additional funding that would require, if I'm understanding that correctly, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Burdick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that's correct.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chair, I guess, yeah, just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I feel like it's easy for us as policymakers to drop in this language and say, we'll just use the money that you already have. But presumably, we made a choice to give them a certain amount of money to do a certain set of things. If we want to add the things for them to do, we got to, and not give any more money, we've got to tell them what we want them not do. I guess I'll be eager to find out from the department how much they think that'll cost, and suggest that we put appropriate funds to that purpose if that's something that's important, which it may well be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually would invite feedback from the department as to how they think this should be handled and what should be reappropriated. That would make more sense than even us coming up with a solution, because we're getting the information as close to the situation as possible. That's how I'd like to handle it.
Representative Lunan, Representative Pinto, I think that's exactly what we're working with the department on. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The department could also suggest whatever taxes they think should be raised to pay for the services. We're the ones who decide what we want the department to do, and then we give you the funds to do it. So we'd like as much input as you can provide as possible to serve the people of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Further questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to move on to a different section, if that's okay. I don't know if we're done with this one.
I think we're concluded. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So I'm interested in Section 25. We're on page 6 of the summary, and this is the new healthcare delivery systems demonstration project, which there was a bill number that I got when we went through this, but this is something that I don't think there was a bill heard on this. This is the healthcare delivery systems demonstration. And I believe that on the spreadsheet, this is an item that is supposed to be saving considerable amount of money. I think this is the $144 and then some million dollars. And I can't find, let's see, where is that on the spreadsheet if anybody has it? I'm on the old one. We're struggling with two different spreadsheets as well as different bills. I'm on the old one. 22. Okay, page 23, Mr. Burke says, 813 is on page 22, and now, okay, yes, I got it here, 813, right, on the original spreadsheet. So this, over the biennium, it's put down as a savings for $144,905,000 in fiscal 18-19, and then just a bit more in fiscal 2021. And this is an issue, this direct contracting, I think it is what this is proposing. It's an idea that I have some interest in, actually, but it didn't get a hearing, and it's being listed as saving a whole bunch of money in this budget. And so I'm really interested to know, first of all, since the committee hasn't had any opportunity to hear any testimony on this, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we could even hear from the department about whether they believe this is something that can actually be done. And I certainly hope it can, because this is the direction I think we should be moving in, as a matter of fact. But I'd like to hear from them on this issue, and then I'd be interested in knowing where that dollar amount came from and if there's a fiscal note on that for this proposal.
Generally, Representative Liebling, we, of course, took this idea from you. And what we've done is it really looks at creating teams to propose bids for total cost of care in contracted agreements, but it doesn't necessarily have to be direct contracting with a group of a hospital or a group. It could be forms of really just kind of creatively asking for teams to come together. We now have the ability to have for-profit groups if they want to form a consulting group, or TPAs to join together with the system, or HMOs to integrate and form teams to do that. So what we're trying to do is develop methods for forecasting utilization and cost to have enrollment so that you have, you link a person with a plan and a system, that you have total cost of care, and then you coordinate care and you provide incentives with skin in the game to coordinate that care. We did have a limited bill that we did look at, which is costed out. We have looked at this in the past. We think that this has the potential for great savings in this demonstration project. It asked for an alternative payment care model by 1-1 of 2018. The payment shall be agreed upon risk-adjusted prospective per capita total cost of care. All enrolled government payment enrollees would qualify, so anybody on a public plan. So that's kind of the idea to ask for and solicit these proposals for teams and total cost of care. So the big differences would be enrollment. You pick a plan, you have coordinated care, and you really drive down the cost within that system. So that's kind of the difference of between the little plan and the big plan is scale. We did have cost on the limited one, and we expanded that based on a wider net. So that's the answer. That's a brief description of kind of where that came from as an idea. Certainly one that we think that we have the time and the ability and expertise within our systems to accomplish. And if anything, I would believe that these saving potentials would be small. So departments down, I welcome them to come forward and testify at this time. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed, Ms. Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Marquardt from DHS. We have only had a little bit of time to digest this language, but I do think the biggest questions we have about it are what we're not sure how it interacts with the current IHP programs, which don't cover the entire MA benefit set. There are things in the total cost of care that are included in their total cost of care calculation, but it's not the entire MA benefit set. So whether that's expected that they would move to something like that where they would have to take on responsibility for all, even long-term care services, or a lot of them don't include dental services, things like that. It's not clear how this interacts with the current managed care purchasing. So whether that is something that is still wrapping around this or whether this is in place of that. I don't think we're clear on how the choice or the enrollment would work as far as how enrollees would know their choices, and particularly the provision that says if they don't make a choice, we're going to assign them. If they're still managed care in those counties, do they have that choice? Do they have to choose one of these? How do we make that assignment? So there's some, I think, just some understanding that we would need to have around this.
Ms. Zimmerman?
Mr. Chair, Marie Zimmerman, DHS. I think the only thing I would add to that is I think we also would maybe want to understand just would need to think about what authority we're doing this under. So we have an authority that we use for IHP. We use a primary care case management authority under Medicaid, and then we have Medicaid managed care. It sounds like this looks a little bit more like Medicaid managed care, if it's something in between, and it would require a waiver. So I think it's just something where we would need to follow up with some more questions regarding that.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think I just heard that without a waiver, you probably can't do this. which, you know, Mr. Chair, I like this. I like the thinking. And, you know, I've been promoting for quite a while that we should move away from having insurance companies between public dollars and public patients. And I've got two bills that have been in this term, two different bills that would accomplish that through different, they have different kind of substitute systems at the back end. And it would have been really great to spend some time really examining these and having the department have some time to look at them, because I do believe that this would save us a lot of money. And not only that, it would save us a lot of money for state dollars. It could be actually used for health care instead of for managing systems that manage health care dollars. So I really like that idea. But it would also be better, I think, for providers on the back end and for patients, who would be less confused by having to pick plans when they're all on Medicaid. So I think there's some real positive, I'm heartened that you're thinking about this and kind of trying to move forward in some direction here. And I'm also heartened that you believe this will save money, because I agree with you. I think that moving away from PMAP would save the state a lot of money in our Medicaid program. But I'm kind of concerned that this didn't get a hearing. We're having a little bit of one now, but very limited. I'm concerned that we're assuming that we're going to get a lot of savings out of this, almost $145 million over the biennium. That's a lot of money when we don't even know if we can get a federal waiver for this. But also, I'm also concerned about how this interacts with another provision. I know we just talked about the provision that was added to have the health plans get enrollees to fill out a form to verify that they're eligible. How does that work with this proposal? Because I assume that some of these people would be ones who otherwise would be on that program.
Correct. I think Representative Liebling, from the standpoint of, I won't say attribution, but enrollment, that you have to know where people are. They have to have some address, even if it's a temporary address, in order to become enrolled in. But to actually have everybody associated with a system and a home is a good thing. And that if we're going to pay for value, we have to figure out where you can get the value in the system. And that, you know, this wouldn't necessarily exclude an HMO from forming a team and doing this, but they may do that in such a way that they get more value from a coordination standpoint that we're currently not seeing. And one of the problems is that the care coordination that is being done isn't getting paid for, that there's not an advantage of doing that. So that's some of the incentives that we're trying to build in. We do say that, the I'm not a robot clause says that, you know, you have to say you're qualified and let the plan that you're associated know that you're qualified. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. If you've got a million people on Medicaid across the state of Minnesota, $150 a person is $150 million. So, you know, $10 per person per month, I think we can find across the system with coordination. And if we can't, then heaven help us, because we're going to need to.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not necessarily opposed to doing that. I'm just wondering how it's going to work with the people that you're pulling out into this program. You know, how those two sections interact. That's really my question to you about it. And, you know, we all have, goals. I think it's pretty much everybody understands that care coordination can save money. I disagree with you that we don't pay for that. We don't always pay for it, but we've certainly moved forward different proposals to pay for that. That's what healthcare homes are, I do believe. And there may be other things as well. So we are definitely moving in that direction. I'm not opposed to the direction. I'm just really puzzled that this came in at the last second, that it didn't get a hearing when it's such a big money item in the bill. So I don't know if this is I certainly hope it's a serious proposal. I think we should be innovating and going in a lot of new directions, because the more efficient we can be with our dollars, the further they can go. And we know in this committee we've got a lot of unmet need. that we could, if we're wasting any dollars, I think we can all agree that we don't want to waste them because we just don't have enough to do the things that we all want to do. But I don't know if this proposal is well thought through. I don't know if it's workable. And to have a budget that builds in $145 million for the biennium for something that the department says you'd need a waiver to do it, I don't know if that's an entirely reasonable thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been talking about direct contracting longer than I'd like to disclose, but I think it's a great idea. And I'm just wondering, did you base the savings on the county-based purchasing groups or other demonstrations in other states? And maybe DHS has more information on that, or maybe you do, Mr. Chair?
Well, we do have some scale that we used as a reference point from the smaller bill, which we did cost out, and just expanded that out and then cut that savings in half from what we thought would be a reasonable portion to try to estimate what a broader uptake might be for the state. So we had some, from the smaller bill, we used that as our primary reference point, but also just looking at the scale across the all of our public program enrollees to look at what a realistic savings might be in a biennium.
Mr. Chair, do we have, is there documented savings from county-based purchasing?
Representative Schultz, there is, we have savings that are captured and shown in several portions of the spreadsheet. Some of those are from not specifically directly related to county-based purchasing, but to our IHPs and to competitive bidding for public programs that we're basing that on. Further discussion. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is the section that I had the question about earlier that you asked me to hold on. And, you know, we, as I said, in the private insurance, we've learned if you divide up the market too many ways, all of a sudden the risk profile starts shifting and changing, and we start ending up with the rate increases that we've seen in the private market. And this feels to me like in your bill you have, you know, many flowers blooming, and you're assuming they're all going to have cost savings. And I'm not, you know, we have this direct purchasing, which I will disagree with Representative Liebling. It requires a third-party administrator and use of them to do the risk. So basically you're going to contract with an insurance company to manage many parts of that, so it isn't really like the county-based purchasing, where I think many of them do have their own staff who do those kind of, you know, that kind of model. We have changes in this bill on the managed care bidding process that also weren't heard and discussed in the way that they're presented in the bill. And then we have our integrated health partnerships, which have been successful, as I've heard, but they took a while to get going. And I'm wondering if the department could help us understand how we could have all of these things going at the same time and get reasonable bids from these different parts of the sector. And would they have to do a consolidated bid calendar? How would this work, particularly when you're letting these be dependent upon enrollee choice, so you couldn't really estimate exactly how many people might pick it? I'm just wondering if the department could share with us how they would see implementing the changes in purchasing and various models that you have in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And if someone wants from the department wants to comment on that, I would certainly welcome that if they would like. What I would say is that enrollees currently enrollees in public plan, in public programs currently have a wide variety of choice of where they can go and who they can see. This particular plan would say that you kind of have to pick one, or we're going to pick one for you. That's different, but it's not one that would be foreign to most folks who work for a company or CGIP or in the individual market. But I also think that we do need to have some choices for people who are on public plans as well as for people who are trying to buy private health insurance. And we are looking for savings from more than one spot in this, and that the flowers are blooming in more than one location, but they're just in different rows in the greenhouse, and we're kind of relying on more of them to do that. Ms. Zimmerman, do you have anything else?
Mr. Chair, and maybe I could confirm as well. My understanding is right now under the prepaid managed care, the bidding contracts, if someone doesn't select the plan, they are automatically enrolled in the lowest cost one in order to keep the state's cost low. So this would change that, and that's not a guarantee that this would be the lowest cost plan. So how would you have this happen? Would it happen all at once and they'd all compete with each other?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, as Ms. Marquardt said, we've only had a little bit of time with this bill to try and think about how it might work. I think in a particular geographic area, so how we procure for IHP, we don't necessarily do it now by a geographic area. We just put it out for the entire state because it participates both under fee-for-service and under managed care currently. For managed care, we obviously do it by county. So I think if this, depending on how this is, would be done, if it would be done by a county, you know, by county, for example, we would likely have to figure out whether or not it could sit alongside IHP, or this would have to be separate from IHP. We'd have to figure out some of those details. Right now, IHP is sort of an underlay under managed care, and they can operate both together. I don't know if it's clear whether or not this and IHP can operate together because they seem very similar, and I think that's part of what I'm hearing the intent is. So I can't really provide all the answers. The question that you had about procurement, I apologize, Representative Loeffler, can you repeat that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was, right now my understanding is that under the basic managed care, that if someone doesn't select, they are defaulted to the lowest cost plan. And this provision would say that if you don't select, you go into this new demonstration project.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's correct. Currently, it's the highest, it's usually the lowest cost, but it's the plan with the highest score. And usually that's also the lowest cost plan, so somebody is defaulted in if they do not make a choice. That's correct.
And Mr. Chair, do we have a fiscal note for this so we could see the projected enrollment and the rollout, that sort of thing?
On the
demonstration project.
Not on the one on page
Section 25.
35, Section 25. Not that one, no. All right. Additional questions? Seeing none. All right. I think we should probably next move to amendments. So I'll move House File 945 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, the bill before us. I'm also going to move A17-0300. And move the A3 amendment. This is an author's amendment. Is House Research prepared to move through that? Yeah. All right. Mr. Chen, you want to start off?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, I'll provide just a very kind of short overview of what's in the A3 author's amendment. So page 1, lines 3 to 5, this is an effective date related to House File 1819, which is the MA drug payment methodology. Then the changes on page 1, line 6 through page 6, line 12, this is putting in House File 1269, which deals with federally qualified health center payment limits. Then page 6, lines 13 to 14, this is just adding some clarifying language to House File 1414 dealing with integrated health partnerships. Lines 15 to 25 of page 6, this is adding more language from the FQHC bill. Page 6, lines 26, this sets the change of ownership fee for prescribed pediatric extended care centers at $4,200. Page 6, line 27 through page 7, line 13, this adds the child care program integrity sections from
House File 887, which is the governor's budget bill. Page 7, line 14 through page 9, line 18. This is adding language from House File 1583, dealing with the basic sliding fee funding priority and allocations. Page 9, line 19 of the amendment, all the way through page 29, line 11. This is, again, adding more child care program integrity sections from the governor's bill. Page 29, line 12 through line 21. This is House File 1384. Page 29, line 22 through page 30, line 22. This is adding House File 1453. This is the bill removing the MFIP marriage disincentive. Then page 20, line 23 through page 31, line 19 adds House File 1412, a program to support adoptive, foster, and kinship families. Then page 31, line 20 through page 32, line 8, it adds, again, sections from House File 1453, dealing with the marriage disincentive. Then page 32, line 9 to page 32, line 25, it adds language from House File 887 related to DHS assessing or investigating maltreatment allegations at Department of Corrections licensed children's residential facilities. Page 32, line 26 to line 30, this is repealer language from House File 887. Page 33, line 2 to line 12, this makes restrictive covenants for healthcare practitioners void in Wabasha County. Page 33, line 13 through line 15 adds language expanding services eligible for mental health innovation grants. Page 33, line 17 through 27, this adds House File 1561. Adds mental health practitioner to the definition of licensed health care provider for purposes of MA coverage of telemedicine services. Page 33, line 28 to page 37, line 26. This is the language from House File 712 dealing with biologic drug substitution. And then page 37, line 27 to page 40, line 2. These modify or correct appropriations numbers to conform with the fiscal notes and the spreadsheet. And just a couple sections maybe to highlight. Page 38, lines 5 and 6, this corrects the appropriation for electronic service delivery documentation systems. Lines 7 through 12 of that page expand the rider on eligibility verification savings to include other DHS programs beyond the healthcare programs. Page 38, lines 26 through 28, then page 39, line 10 through 26, this moves the rider on DWRS transition grants to the right section. Page 39, lines 5 to 6, expand DHS use of federal funds for adoption, kinship, and foster care services. Page 39, line 9, removes an unnecessary reference to a grant recipient in a rider. And that concludes our overview of the A3 amendment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chen. First, let's adopt the A17 dash. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could get a little explanation on page 33, lines 2 to 10. I've never seen us deal with restrictive covenants for a particular in health providers in a particular county. And not knowing the backstory, it seems like it might be an unusual precedent for us.
All right, Representative Loeffler. Perhaps Representative Haley might give a little bit of a background on a specific piece in the bill.
I'd be happy to, Chair and Representative Loeffler. This relates to an issue that came up in our community that I represent, which is the city of Wabasha, that has had trouble in their reduction of primary care and mid-level providers. 2 years ago, they had 10 primary care providers, and they are now down to 2. So it's an issue of in an area that has limited competition, and with health care reform, limited access, particularly in a community that is most of the residents are older in that county, and a lot of the residents would be residents of low income means. So we are trying to improve access and make sure that primary care is available.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Haley, I'm sympathetic to the health care workforce shortage, which I know is more severe in parts of the state than other parts of the state. But I'm wondering if we're interfering in some legal dispute within your community, within Wabasha County, whether or not we're interfering in contracts. And I've never seen us in this committee ever get involved to that level. And so the workforce shortage is about recruitment and retention and paying. It's not about changing contractual terms of individuals who might be currently practicing. And so I'm just feeling like this is an unusual step, and without knowing the background, I'm uncomfortable with it.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I have flagged the exact same section as we went through the bill, and I, in addition to what Representative Loeffler said, I certainly agree with her. This is a very strange thing to, I know that covenants, non-competition covenants can be problematic. They certainly can, but they are legal. They are a matter of contract sometimes. And what this is basically doing is nullifying part of a contract, apparently, in that certain county. And I wonder why we wouldn't, first of all, I didn't hear as Mr. Chun went through this that was ever a bill. So I'd certainly like to know that. And whether it was or wasn't a bill, I think this is something that should be heard in the Civil Law Committee, because this has to do with contracts between private parties, something that I've never seen us deal with in this committee.
All right. Further discussion? All right. Seeing none, what I'd like to do is adopt the A17-300. Yeah, I did move. I moved 945 before us. We'll adopt the A17-300. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Say no. The 300 is before us. And further discussion to the A3. The A3, further discussion. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really think this is very problematic, and I sort of like to hear an answer on the question about shouldn't this go to civil law. This just appeared in this amendment. I don't know where else it's been. I don't know if there's been an opportunity for anybody to weigh in on it. Maybe Representative Haley could tell us, the opposing party, whoever that is, whether they even know that this is happening, because I think for us in the legislature to be interfering in somebody's contractual agreements without even notifying them is problematic in the extreme. So I'd really like to hear whether there's, the other side, who I suspect may be a large healthcare system with which we may be familiar, very familiar here, and, in fact, may have its headquarters in my district, although I'm not sure if that's who we're talking about. But I would certainly like to know if there's been some opportunity to respond from whoever that adverse party is.
Representative Liebling, from what I understand of the situation, is that it's not one that's that is foreign to Wabasha County or this town. But one that we're probably going to be seeing a lot more of as networks narrow and kind of grind together around the state. And I think narrowing it to a specific region makes some sense because of the fact that you bring up. But I have not heard from Civil Law Committee that this would, in fact, divert it to that direction. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair, and fellow members. I have been working on this issue, and all parties have been involved in a lot of discussion and negotiation. I'm happy to talk with you about that offline if you wish.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I am wondering if Representative Haley has spoken with Chair Scott, and if we know. I was on civil law last term, and it does feel like the sort of thing I would think the committee would want to see, but not sure if she's spoken with the chair, who may not be aware of this otherwise.
Representative Pinto, we do have a hearing in civil law tomorrow on HHS provisions, so we could certainly bring that up at that time if that's an issue that Chair Scott would like to see. We'd certainly do that. I do not know whether or not it is or it isn't, because I haven't talked to them.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify that, so is this provision going to be heard in the civil law committee as part of, you were saying, parts of this bill are going to civil law?
We do have sections of the bill will be in civil law tomorrow, yes. And this could certainly be discussed at that time, and that would be up to Representative Scott.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to be clear. I'm not taking a side in the dispute. I don't exactly know what the dispute is. And I certainly think that the issue about, workforce shortages is certainly a serious issue. I just think that procedurally, we need to make sure that everybody gets a chance to be heard and that we're doing something that's legal. Because if we're interfering in contract, I'm not sure that's something that we even really can do. So I don't know if, I'm not going to ask the staff to weigh in on that right now, but I think that's potentially problematic for the bill. So thank you. Right.
Appreciate the point, Representative Liebling. Further discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
The A3 is adopted. First up, we'll have Representative Zerwas, the A16. Representative Zerwas moves the A16 amendment before the committee. Representative Zerwas of the A16.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A16 amendment is a language fix to remove the word education from the Board of Psychology's mission statement, and the refinement of the diagnostic assessment so that's a little bit more flexible and meets the individual's needs. This language was provided by DHS and has been vetted by stakeholders.
All right, discussion to the A16 amendment. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Zerwas. I understand that both NAMI and Wilder were involved in that discussion with the Department of Human Services. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is my understanding. I have NAMI, Mental Health America, Wilder, and HCMC listed as the stakeholders that were involved in this discussion along with the department. You have to excuse me. This was originally a Representative Keel bill through policy and animus, and this tweak was given to me by an advocate. So I'm not very deep other than just getting secondhand what the discussions were.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zerwas, that is what I understood to be the case as well. I just want to make sure it's on the record.
Further discussion to the A16 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the A16 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A16 is adopted. Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton has the A21 amendment. Representative Hamilton moves the A21 amendment before us. Representative Hamilton to the A21.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this may have been addressed in the A3 amendment on lines 33.2 to 33.27. If not, I'll go ahead and amend with this language, Mr. Chairman.
All right, let me just quick and verify whether or not that was picked up in the A3.
Mr. Chair, the language on page 33 of the A3, that's dealing with the telemedicine provision that applies to health plans generally. The A21 amendment is, I guess, adding a similar definition just to the section on MA coverage of telemedicine services.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and adopt the 821 in that case, Representative Hamilton.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion of the 821 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the 821, please say aye.
All right.
Those opposed, no. The 821 is adopted. Amendment 22, Representative Hamilton moves the 822 amendment. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment makes wording changes worked out between the Safety Net Coalition, DHS, and other stakeholders. With the new wording, there's no additional cost for this item. The amendment requires DHS to consider adjusting a standardized quality matrix to be more suitable for complex safety net patient populations. Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
All right. Questions for the 822 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the 822, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The 822 is adopted. Representative Zerwas to the 823 amendment. Representative Zerwas moves the 823 amendment. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The 823 amendment is the latest iteration of ongoing negotiations between the health plans, county-based purchasers, and Department of Human Services on the competitive bidding language within the bill. Discussions with the department are ongoing. Just wanted to update the committee on where we're at as of now.
All right, discussion. Discussion to the 823. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is, so as of now, the department still doesn't believe the language is able to be implemented. I guess Representative Ross can just comment on that.
Representative Ross.
Mr. Chair, members, I guess whether it can be or they want it to might be the distinguishing factor. I know there's still disagreement on the appeals process. The department would still like the commissioner that makes the original decision also decide the appeals. We don't think that's a very good appellate process. So that's what the second portion of the amendment does. I know there's still some consternation around that. And like I said, discussion continues.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Further discussion. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the 823 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The 823 is adopted. The 825 amendment, Representative Schumacher. On behalf of Representative Baker, Representative Schumacher is not here. I will move the 825 amendment, which I understand is a grant program, and there has and represents an agreement between the department and providers. The department can correct me if I understand, but there is a resolution on this issue. Yes. Questions to the 825? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the 825, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The 825 is adopted. Amendment 812, Representative Considine moves the 812 amendment. Representative Considine, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like a roll call on this one.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
I can't begin to tell you how disappointed, frustrated, and angry I am that once again the home health aides, the PCAs, have been ignored. They've been screwed. This is a group of hardworking Minnesotans, and we continue to ignore them. They work with the most vulnerable people in our society, the developmentally disabled, the mentally ill, the elderly. And as I have pointed out repeatedly, they are using food stamps to feed their own children. This Beth's Health Alliance is what I describe as being woefully inadequate, but at this point, it's better than nothing. What I would like to do is take the very, very generous estate tax provision that benefits the wealthiest 800 families in the state and use that to offer that to pay for the 4% and 4%.
All right. Discussion to the A-12 amendment. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor the point here, but this really kind of goes to the heart of the matter about what priorities are being set in this legislature this year. And so I appreciate that Representative Considine has brought this forward. And I just wanted to think for a second about Jeff Bangsberg, who was a citizen advocate who came before this committee on numerous occasions to talk about this issue, actually wanting to raise the rate even a little more for people who deal with the most complex. And remember, he told us that two of his friends literally died because they could not get the help they needed to pay for their care. He described two cases in which one person, I think, got sepsis for being had bed sores, and but there were two people who died from not having the care they needed, and he said that because of the shortage. And yet this bill has nothing in it, nothing at all, to deal with that problem. So I thank you, Representative Considine. I hope everyone will vote yes on this.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a comment. Right now, I believe we're taking the money you're saying from the estate tax. Is that correct? I'm looking to Considine,
yes.
Representative Considine. And the concern that I have is, number one, I support as far as giving these people additional monies. The concern that I have is that the individuals that are impacted currently are many of the family farmers, the individuals that I represent. And we're having to sell off farmland to pay off these taxes. And when we see a bunch of consolidation taking place in the agriculture community, and it increases, and it's more and more difficult for young and beginning farmers to get into farming and to keep the family farm within the family, I'm a little concerned as far as where we're taking the money from in this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
For a family, there's a $10 million threshold. So that would be, what, 10,000 acres at $10,000 an acre, which, as we all know, farmland has dropped. 20,000 acres at $5,000 an acre. There are very, very few places where this is going to affect any farmer. I'm sorry, that just does not hold up.
Well, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Considine, for bringing this. It brings, I think, in one amendment, sharp relief about the choices that we're making in this legislature. And, you know, Representative Hamilton, I appreciate your argument. I do. But I recall when I was the majority leader and we were also having a debate about the care of people with disabilities in homes, how many group homes and family homes I visited in Greater Minnesota, how many families were struggling with this very issue to care for their loved one adequately. This is an issue for people all over the state of Minnesota, and it's getting worse. It's getting worse for people because we're not attending to it, and we're literally leaving people stranded. So I know that this is a tough choice, the tough amendment for sure. But I think that in this committee, we need to think about people all over the state of Minnesota. And it is our obligation to look out not only for the people who are living with disabilities, but also for the people who care for them. And we could give them a hand by passing this amendment, and we should.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I also am happy that Representative Considine brought this forward, and we should definitely be funding our PCAs. I just want to address the comment about small businesses and farms. Across the country, only 20 small businesses and small farm estates paid any estate tax in 2013, according to the Tax Policy Center. So I don't know what that number is for Minnesota, but I'm guessing it's very, very small. And in our current estate tax policy, we exclude property from small businesses and homestead farmlands up to $5 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is an important statement of our major responsibilities. And, you know, the Health and Human Services Committee is really about the welfare of our people, and I think we share a lot of common values about trying to get people to self-sufficiency, trying to make sure that people's basic health care needs are met when they are in confronting terminal illness, severe disability, adjusting to the blows of life, and helping them get on their feet and move on. And I think our number one priority is to have a sense of urgency about the things that are falling apart, and that's one thing that I don't see in this bill. We are right now under court order, federal court supervision, because we have violated the constitutional rights, the U.S. constitutional rights of people with disabilities in this state, because we have not done what other states have done. We're one of the worst in the nation in getting people with disabilities employed and getting people with disabilities living independently, which, by the way, saves money and gives them a happier life, which I think one of our goals is to save public money, but it ought to be by lifting people up, not pulling them down. And what we have heard is that people who have gotten that golden ticket to independent employment can't get to work because they can't find someone who will help lift them out of bed, get them dressed, help them eat and brush their teeth so they can go to work and be self-sufficient. We have been told that there has been, for the past 2 years, 8,000 to 9,000 vacancies every single day. Every single person served by those persons is potentially in a crisis if that person isn't going to be there to help them get into bed and they're having to spend the night in their chair. I don't want the federal courts to be running our human services system. I want us to be moving forward, lifting people up, making them independent, but it's not going to help. This year, I thought things were the same as last year, and then we heard the report from the Commissioner of Health, and they got a record 7,000 reports of potential abuse, neglect, and maltreatment. They're able to investigate at most 10 to 20% of them. They go by different categories. So the safety net that even checks in on these people and corrects problems when their caregivers aren't reliable aren't here every day. In three licensed healthcare facilities, there are medication errors. Some of those, I suspect, are from the most dedicated people in employment in this business who are making $13, $12 an hour, but they're on their sixth day of double shifts, and the worst thing they could ever live with is that they mixed up someone's medications or forgot and gave them a double dose. And yet we're putting people daily into those kind of compromising situations, and to not step up after, I think it's 4 years of zero increase, is not right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I wish to correct my math.
Thank you.
I was trying to do it in my head real quick. At 2,000 acres at 5,000, but as Representative Schultz points out, the first 5 million are exempt.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say one of us needed to correct our math or double check our math.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
It was me.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with their arguments. I truly don't understand as far as the need and whatnot. I wanted to make the case as far as where the dollars are coming from. And some of the challenges that we have within the area that I represent as well, when it comes to consolidation and whatnot, forced consolidation in many instances. That was my point, Mr. Chair.
Fair enough. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Other discussion? Seeing no other discussion, roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
No.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Fisher.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Greenhagen.
No.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Halverson. Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Lunin.
No.
Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Schultz?
Yes.
Representative Zerwas?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 14 noes, the amendment is not adopted. All right, next up we have Representative Murphy, the A14-1 amendment. Representative Murphy moves the A14-1. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will try and be surgical with this in terms of words and time. I want to begin by recognizing the hard work that's gone into putting this bill together by both members of the majority, members of the minority, and our staff. I think that the chair and the committee has been delivered a very unsatisfactory target, and so we're in the position that we're in, and I want to say that I find that disappointing, but it is where we is. It is where we are. Excuse me about that. Right now, one thing that is glaringly obvious that is missing in this piece of legislation from my perspective is any action on child care. We've had a committee that came together, that traveled the state, that listened to Minnesotans. We know that there's a problem, and there's very little in this bill on that front, and that is one of the major disappointments for me. And I'm saying that now because I'm not going to say it again when we're done. This amendment removes the sections of the legislation that have, from my perspective, savings that aren't verified yet with the fiscal note. I understand the promise of some of the ideas that are embedded in this bill and want to continue to work with the majority on them, but I think it is wrong to put into the bill so much that is accounted as savings when we don't really know that they're savings at all. That seems like a false promise to people that could yield real consequences for people down the line if we made this the law of Minnesota, because if we don't realize the savings that come from these promising ideas, what means then that DHS would have to come behind in some way, form, or fashion and make up the difference. And we know the people served in the Department of Human Service programs are vulnerable. So I don't think it is right for us to move a bill out of this committee with this level of unsubstantiated savings. And for that reason, I am moving that we strip them out. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you.
All right. Further discussion to the A14-1 amendment. I would just respectfully disagree with Representative Murphy. I think while we are very put in a position that we're always having a position with a target and a budget that. The best thing about this committee and the worst thing about this committee is the same thing, is that there's lots of good things that we can do, and it's not a choice between good things and bad things. It's usually a choice between two good things or three good things, and that's the good and the bad part about the committee. But I do appreciate where you're coming from, but I would respectfully ask members to vote against the A14-1. Further discussion? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I understand the amendment and the concern here is that in this case we're not choosing between two good things. We're choosing between one good thing and something else that we just don't know what the numbers are. And I guess the concern that I have, as I understand Representative Murphy in bringing this forward, has is that there are real consequences that will come from this bill that we move out of this committee. We want to make sure those real consequences are based on real numbers. And if we don't know what the numbers are, if they're simply, in some cases anyway, kind of plucked out of the air, then that means even greater concern about the consequences that result. So we do face tough choices, but it feels like they need to be choices that are based on fact and based on numbers that have been determined by folks who've looked at them and provided the expertise that the fiscal notes provide. So I speak in support of the amendment and want to make sure that we're making those sorts of those tough decisions based on the facts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fair enough, Representative Pinto. We do need to do the best we can with the information that we have, and we're going to have to ask our providers to do more things and to be become more creative and more competitive in many circumstances, and so we are going to have to ask them to work harder and move further. So I think that the bill is moving in the right direction. I know where you'd like to be with some of those assurances. We'd all like them, and unfortunately, we're going to have to move ahead with the people and the information that we have. So with that, I'm sorry, Representative Schultz, I didn't see you there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am really concerned about these fake savings because they do have real consequences. We're talking about people's lives and their health. And I'm really worried about, for example, in the audit, you have for capita savings of $170 million in 2018-19 and $180 million in 2021. And that was based on an audit that used data that's not accessible to DHS. And also was based on savings from Illinois. And I looked back and did some research on what Illinois actually saved in their audits. And I found that they only saved $2.6 million in 2013 after paying $70 million to a contractor to look for ineligibility. And they had to hire 200 new caseworkers. So I'm worried that, especially in the 2021, that savings is not going to be realized, and it's going to affect put the rest of the budget out of balance.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. And if you're in the room, we were informed that actually capital investment did, in fact, have the schedule at 3. So if you're in the room and you feel like you're in high school and you're in the wrong class, you'll be in room 10. Capital investment has now moved to room 10 for that. So if you're here or if you are watching this and trying to find where that is in room 10. Representative Schultz, I do appreciate that, and again, would refer you to the OLA reports where we have found just across 5 months and 40% of our programs up to $271 million in appropriation that is in the wrong place and for paying for people who are not qualified. If you look to the MMB's own spreadsheet, we see that by not implementing the periodic data match that we are showing that we're currently paying for $50 million of attributed costs just within that sheet. I think that these savings are very realistic, and in my opinion, I would like to see a lot more in the upcoming 2 years than what we have forecasted. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will note that and nowhere in this bill do we fund the technology requests that we heard from yesterday in testimony. We heard from former Republican Senator Sheila Cascaden, who's now a county commissioner, that she's willing to step up to participate in these kind of things, but because the counties are still the key point of entry for eligibility. But they can't do it without the tools. They're using 1980s computer systems that we're going to get tons of false positives that they're going to have to track down. And there's no money in this bill for the IT systems that would actually streamline what you're attempting to do or the personnel that are going to have to follow up on these things manually for every false positive or real positive that shows up in these. And so, this bill is also going to contribute to either real frustration when we look at the progress in implementing this again one more year down the line, and we're going to see increased property taxes.
All right, thank you, Representative Loeffler. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the Murphy A14-1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The A14-1 Murphy amendment is not adopted. Next up, Representative Liebling has her A20-1. Representative Liebling moves the A20-1. Representative Liebling to the A20-1.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I would like a roll call on this one.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Liebling to your members.
So, members, you've seen this language before. I had an amendment that had language, this language and other language. Some of what I had in my other amendment is already in the bill. The chair chose to take it and put it into the bill. And what I've got here is other language that he didn't use. Now, just to refresh your memory, this if we really want to save money,
And we really all should be concerned about fraud, and we should be concerned about making sure our dollars, our medical system's dollars, go where we intend them to go. We are paying, according to the OLA, about $2.8 billion a year for home and community-based services, and DHS does not have the tools to properly track and understand where all of that is going. So when we talk about the need to raise rates, and, you know, all of those things we know are very real from the stories that we hear. However, we don't have a very good way to make sure that that $2.8 billion per year is really well accounted for. So this is language that came from DHS. It does not have a cost. It needs to go into this bill because this is not going to save money this year. We can't book it on the spreadsheet. But it is very important that we move this language forward so that we can get our arms around this. One of the largest provider of home and community-based services in the state, according to the OLA report, one provider is getting over $140 million per year, and that's a for-profit provider. Not that, you know, a nonprofit, says we know the money can leak out also from them, but we need to just make sure that what we're paying, we're getting what we're paying for. And that's what this language helps to do for the future. So I hope that you can support this language.
All right. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also support the amendment that Representative Liebling has put out there. I know that the thing that concerned me is we heard a lot about the black box, and it's helped really hard to follow the money that's going through here. And we're taking with the folks the fact that at some point we'd like to get more money to the people who are doing the core of this work, the personal care attendants. We want to make sure we've got a way to find out that the money is getting to the folks that deserve it down the road. And I think this goes a long way to helping address that problem, and would ask for a yes vote on this amendment.
All right. Further discussion? Representative Lunan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns, I agree with the importance of making sure that the money is spent functionally. We're at a time right now where the reimbursement rates are challenging for these businesses, and the resources it's going to take for this type of documentation is going to take away from that or put a burden on that. It seems to me that we've got some other resources available to check on that or keeping on it that we're doing currently, and this just seems like another layer of work that isn't actually going to do the actual service. So I'm not going to support this amendment.
All right, Representative Lunan, as I look at the Liebling 820-1 amendment, I see much of the pieces of this look familiar. We have adopted some of these portions. However, I think the pieces that you look at within the additional requirements from the providers, I don't believe are worked out and doesn't represent an agreement with the providers or DHS, so I would oppose the Liebling 820-1 amendment. Further discussion? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this language comes from DHS, and honestly, if we're paying for services from providers and they don't want to provide this kind of documentation, I just really wonder what's going on. Now, I did have a bill in for this. It could have been heard. There could have been additional work. We could have had testimony from providers about this, but the chair did not see fit to do that. This language, I believe, is also in the governor's budget. So, it just amazes me when we have a bill before us that has such fictitious numbers in it and is asking DHS to do things that they've now said they need a waiver for, and that are really huge things that went through this committee without a hearing. It just really boggles my mind that there is objection to this kind of common sense reporting. And this bill is, it's not done today. It's going to still move forward. If there are particular issues to this, I think there's still time for somebody to step forward and say, you know, take out this line or tweak that line. I don't know why, you know, that certainly can happen. But my goodness, to oppose just... We're going to pay people money for services, and we're not going to require them to report to DHS what we are buying. That's what this is about, what we are buying. So it boggles my mind that members, any member who has a concern about an extra $47 million, I think it is, on the data match issue, and, you know, I think that's a very serious issue, too, that we're not having people on our programs who don't belong there. But we also shouldn't be paying money out to providers not knowing that the money is actually buying the services that we think it's buying. So, I mean, if you want to vote no, vote no. But I would think that your constituents would be very, very unhappy about such a vote.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, I'll note that if the objection is that the wording still needs to be worked on, I'll point out that the ZERWAS amendment was adopted a couple of minutes ago, and that was one that still the wording needed to be worked on along the process, and we moved that one along. It seems like the value here is strong enough that if there's a few wording issues to be addressed, given that the Representative Lieberman's bill wasn't even given a hearing, it seems like it would make sense for it to be included in the bill, and then those wording issues can be addressed just as the other amendments we've adopted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I ditto Representative Pinto, and also say, you know, Representative Liebling has a good idea that has, you know, garnered support from a variety of places, and I think that, you know, she's worked very hard to try and get it heard in amendment form, and there's room in the bill for this idea, and if we can't get it worked out, she can't get it worked out, then there's a way to remedy that. So I'd ask for a yes vote. Thanks.
All right. Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
Chair Dean.
No.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Fisher.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Greenhagen. Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Pass.
Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Lunan.
No.
Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Yes.
Representative Schumacher. Representative Schultz.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
There being 9 ayes and 11 nays, the amendment is not adopted. All right. Representative Hamilton.
Am I out, Mr. Chairman?
You'd like.
Do I have an amendment? Right. Passed out, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
All right, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this amendment met deadline. I'm not even sure if it's germane to this bill or if it belongs in this committee, Mr. Chairman. However, Mr. Chairman, I had great success a couple of years ago with your help, actually. With your help. Mr. Chairman, we're passing out a little amendment as it pertains to well drillers. And as you recall, Mr. Chairman, with your help, we were able to change it. And the way the law states currently, before, well drillers had to do all the work on the wells. And then the law was changed that said a plumber could step in if you could not find a well driller within 25 miles. Then, Mr. Chairman, you changed the law just a couple of years ago, Mr. Chairman, to expand that out to 50 miles. You couldn't find a well driller within 50 miles. What we're saying is, let's leave it up to the experts, and let's eliminate that as far as allowing the plumbers to do the well driller's job. This is a public safety issue, Mr. Chairman. And again, with your such strong support just a few short years ago, I felt like it would be a great idea to bring this up once again, and I ask for your support, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I stand for questions.
Discussion to the April Amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zerwas.
I'm just so proud of Representative Hamilton for bringing this amendment forward today. And I'm proud to support your efforts and urge your green vote and urge everyone really to come together on this pressing HHS issue.
All right. Further discussion, Representative Considine?
Representative Loeffler.
I've got capital investment, and I'd like to conclude the business here. I'm 15 minutes late for that committee now.
Leaving each other. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know I'm usually a stickler on process, and I've been a little irritated with all the new things that were never heard. But, you know, this has been, the governor declared it, the year of water. And this is about water quality and public health. Nothing is more essential to public health than having clean water to drink and know that it's safe no matter where you live, whether there's a plumber within 50 miles or not.
This did not meet deadline. It does not belong in this committee. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. The amendment does not pass. The amendment is not adopted. All right.
See you in Ways and Means, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Final discussion to the... I'm sorry. Oh. All right. Staff, we'll just do a minor amendment to allow technical corrections to the omnibus bill if you'd like to... do we need wording with that or do we not?
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to point out there's a line error on page 39 of the A3 amendment, if I can fix that.
All right.
Page 39, line 28, it reads line 27. It should read line 28. That's all.
All right. Technical correction, all those in favor of adoption of the technical correction, please say aye. Opposed, no. Also direct staff to make any technical corrections to the bill necessary for the final bill. Final discussion before we move House Bill 945. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I think that we got a rotten target. And so we're in this place. And when I think about the choice we're making in the legislature, again, in the House, this term is significant tax cuts in the tax bill, which we have already heard in Ways and Means, at the expense of people who need a little help because they're vulnerable. You know that. I know that. It is it's an unfortunate situation we find ourselves in. The thing that I am most frustrated with about this, right, what's missing in the bill, we've talked about that. People who care for the people who are vulnerable, people who are vulnerable themselves. But we're really not making any headway on what are some significant challenges in our future, right? When I think about an aging population across the state of Minnesota, when I think about people with disabilities and a shrinking workforce, when I think about the healthcare workforce, that woman in Benson who said, I don't know what's going to happen if I don't have a doctor or a nurse here, we are treading water. And I know there are efforts in the legislation, and there are some things in here that I support, but the robust attack on our future is absent here. And it's in large part, because the speakers decided that we're going to do big tax cuts instead of investing in our people. And that's just wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong for our future. And I am, bummed out about that target, Mr. Chair, because I think if you'd gotten a better target, you'd gotten a better bill.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Loeffler.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm going to honor the people who need to get to...
No. Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We might have been confused as we used to be. It's been a while. So, I just wanted to say about the bill that, to represent Murphy's point, yeah, it was a rotten target, but I think that by all of you voting, by the Republicans on this committee voting to favor rich dead people over people who need PCAs, that you've all made your choice very clear. I don't think we can blame a target, because obviously the target is the choice of the Republican members. And Republican members on this committee, we figured you brought about over $2 billion worth of bills to this committee. And I thought that was good. Obviously, we always have to make choices. We can never afford all of the things that we know that we want or need. But for you to bring over $2 billion worth of
worth of bills means that you recognize that there is tremendous need in this state, that a lot of our citizens, the people with disabilities who are talking about the spend down, and my goodness, the people on MFIP, the children on our welfare program, our Minnesota Family Investment Program, who are living below 60% of the poverty level. And yet there's nothing for them in this bill at all. So, you know, I think that you've pretty much made your choice here. It's clear. This is about values. And, yeah, you've got a target for the committee, but you're also expressing your values. There are many good things in this bill. There really are, and it's good to see that there's, you know, some commitments to changing, making our mental health system better, and a lot of other good things. However, those good things are financed with funny money because of the cuts in this bill that are not real, because of the savings in this bill that will not materialize. So people that came and testified and said, thank you for doing this and thank you for doing that, those things in this bill are based on sand. And that is really concerning, because worse than saying no is saying yes when you don't mean it. And so I hope that the people in this committee who sat here day after day after day hearing about the needs throughout Minnesota in all of our districts, all of these people that we all care about, I hope that moving forward, when you take that vote for that tax bill, you are saying no to the needs here. And we all know we have to make choices. We all know that we have to do that every darn time, and it's a very tough committee because of that. But the choices we should be making should not be between people, very rich dead people, and people who are very much alive and need a little bit of help to really live a full life. That is really, in my view, wrong, and that's what this bill is really doing.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I support everything that my DFL colleagues have said about this bill. I'm really concerned about not adjusting for inflation and actually removing that when we do our forecasts and our budgets, and no one would do their own personal budget that way, and so I'm very concerned that in this bill we take out the inflation adjustment for our public programs.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a note, you know, on tax cuts. You know, one of the bills we passed and the governor signed this session is the federal tax conformity. If you go to the fiscal analysis page, the House one, it shows that in fiscal year 2018, the general fund will have over $22 million less because of the federal tax conformity, which gave tax cuts to certain individuals and or businesses in our state. However, in fiscal year 2021, because of the federal tax cut conformity, it shows a $90 million increase in revenues. So lower taxes, competitive, and regulations that are competitive with other states and a global economy actually produce higher tax revenues. And then we will be in a better position to help the people with their needs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I valued about being in this role is helping constituents just understand the complexities of this place, like the fact that, because this is not very clear to people often, that there are these targets that are set by the majority that then govern what happens from there on. And the target, as has been said, that was given to this committee in a time of surplus for health and for support for people who are the most vulnerable was a $600 million cut, and the chair has done much effort to address that. But the result of trying to deal with that is that we have these what really are fake numbers, where we don't have a way of knowing that these are actually going to lead to real savings, and in the meantime, we've got real consequences on people's lives. The result of that is that we have to do a maneuver, as referred to by Representative Schultz, of simply pretending that there will not be inflation in the next couple of years, and then we'll find out sort of what the result is. That's what is contained in this, by removing the forecast inflation for medical assistance. And so what I thought I was going to be talking about today was the fact that to try to explain that there really is this choice has been referred to between tax cuts for very wealthy individuals and for property owners of some really high-value properties, skyscrapers, big-box retail stores, many of them out of state, and then the choices of protecting and taking care of the vulnerable people. But we had this amendment that actually presented that choice very starkly. And so I just think it's important for folks who are watching and perhaps particularly caring about some particular area that they were hoping would be supported. I'm guessing that Representative Constantine brought that amendment forward as we know he cares so deeply about the issue of home health aides. He's been sending emails to us just regularly and working on all of us on this daily, as he says. But presumably we could have done that amendment on a whole variety of issues, the choice of taking care of families on welfare against this tax paid by, I said, by very wealthy estates, assistance in child care for low-income families, for a variety of things that against this tax on very wealthy estates. And if there are folks in the majority who would say, you know, no, we would in fact choose to use that money to make sure to pay for that and to maybe cut that estate tax by somewhat less, please bring that forward. We would love to hear that, because we've seen as the choice was made today, and as I say, based on what we've seen along the way, that choice would have been made the same way as well. And I find that very frustrating at this time, that the people we've been hearing from for these last couple months would be put in such a difficult position because of those choices being made. So I'm opposed to the bill, but I certainly appreciate the effort put into it, and I hope that we can figure out a better path forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Constantine.
Maybe there'll be $90 million in 4 years. We have a $1.65 billion surplus right now. There is no better time than to address these needs than right now. I'm a no on the vote, and I'm going to head to capital investment. Thank you.
Thanks for your efforts, Representative Considine.
Thank
Good
you,
luck on Chair. Capital investment for next year. All right. Sure. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of want to make a couple of comments along the line, as I know that we talked about the estate tax a little bit earlier. And seeing my name's been attached to that in a number of committees already, I'd like to make a comment on that. Is when I originally came to the tax committee with the estate bill, I made it very clear that we had a large surplus and that there are a number of things that could be addressed. One of them was for conformity on the estate tax. But I also made it very clear that there was a lot of money there and that we should also be addressing very important needs, whether it was education, and more specifically, I called out the personal care attendant situation that we're having the problem with here within this committee. And I feel very strongly that if we're not able to afford to provide the money to take care of the personal care attendants and meet some of the needs of economic assistance that some of our Minnesotans need here, then we really don't have enough money to do any of these kind of other tax cuts out there. I sympathize with the chair because he was given a bad number, but I'm also concerned by about some of the creative savings that had to come up to try to make his budget number work. My fears are that if those savings are not realized, that at some point in the future, that may be the wedge of people will come in and say, we're going to, instead of addressing what might be happening in the tax code, they're going to come back and try to take those savings out on those who are at the economic disadvantage here, those who are disabled, and those who are homeless. And that is my fear as we go forward.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just want to remind you all that we are preserving the automatic inflationary adjustment rates for community-based waiver services scheduled for July 1st, 2017, and that is maintaining the 7% rate increases enacted over the past 4 years. So we do have that in the bill, something to look forward to as we continue this conversation.
All right. Further discussion? All right, seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 945, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
945, as amended, is re-referred. Members, just for moving forward, Representative Schultz.
I have an announcement. It can wait, though.
Okay. Just for moving forward, I just want to thank all of the folks who put the bill together, particularly the staff, House Research, Randy Chun, Danielle Pinelli, Elizabeth Clarkfest, Sarah Sunderman, our fiscal analyst Doug Berg, the revisor's office, Sandy Glass, Annie Fox, Lauren Bethke, our page, Adam, and DFL Research, Cassandra Moore, GOP Research, Bethany Dorabella, and Chelsea Whitman, our slightly above average CLA, Shiloh Larson, SDA's Laura Larson, and Holly Iverson, of course. Thank you all for the really strong work on putting it together, particularly in the last week, all of the late nights for changes and everything that does
Mr. Chair, did you come mention up. Randy Chun?
Absolutely.
He was the first one.
First one. Absolutely. So we do thank you. We will be meeting again. We do have other things on the docket, so it will be au revoir and not goodbye, and look forward to the next time we see all the folks back here in room 200. With that, we will not be adjourned. Representative Schultz has an announcement.
I just want to invite the committee members and staff and everyone in the room to Duluth and St. Louis County Days tonight at 4:30 at Intercontinental Hotel. So there's going to be a shuttle at the Capitol running starting at 4 o'clock. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. And with that, we are adjourned.